As you've now put together, our text for today comes from the book of Job. Job is one of those stories that we know and we're aware of in the Bible, but outside of two or three golden quotes, that's really all we know of it or do with it. Everything else is just sort of out there and here. And I can even remember the first time where I went from knowing, well, Job is about a guy who suffers, to actually reading Job and learning that, oh, Job is a guy that suffers due to a bet between God and Satan. Ha. Okay. And we work with this and trying to figure it out and knowing what to do. And before I read the text, I wanted to make one note. I'm going to be reading from the Jewish Publication Society English version of the text. As the name suggests, it's a very Hebraic rendering of the text. And here it goes so far as to say the adversary as opposed to Satan. And this isn't to be PC and dodge Satan or the devil or the rest, but simply it is more true to the Hebrew, to the one who opposes and is there, and the one who is part of the underside of faith. So this is how the story of Job starts. The text on the screen isn't going to be the same. I just didn't have it for the screen, so you can translate in your head. This is Job, verse 1, and then chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. There was a man in the land of Uz named Job. That man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. One day, the divine beings presented themselves before the Lord. The adversary came along with them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord, Yahweh, said to the adversary, "Where have you been?" The adversary answered the Lord, "I have been roaming all the earth." The Lord said to the adversary, "Have you noticed my servant Job? There's no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil. He still keeps his integrity, so you have incited me against him to destroy him for no good reason." The adversary answered the Lord, "Skin for skin. All that a man has, he will give up for his life. But lay a hand on his bones and his flesh, he will surely blaspheme you to your face." So the Lord said to the adversary, "See, he's in your power. Only spare his life." The adversary departed from the presence of the Lord and inflicted a severe inflammation on Job, from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He took a pot charred to scratch himself as he sat in the ashes. His wife said to him, "You still keep your integrity. Blaspheme God and die." But he said to her, "You talk as any shameless woman might talk. Shall we accept only good from God and not accept evil?" For all that, Job said nothing sinful. So what do we do with this? Job is one of these books that ought to come with a full set of pharmaceutical disclaimers at the bottom. Be careful how you read this. It may well give you a headache. Like all moods altering substances, care needs to be exercised in how we encounter the words and ideas held within. And this was just a little bit of a snippet of the story. I skipped over the part where God allows Satan the first time to come and destroy everything that Job has. And any story that presents the possibility that God and Satan casually subject the mortal population to basically a gentleman's wager a la Pygmalion or the like has to be treated with a good deal of scrutiny. And rightly so. Because as much as we herald Job for patient perseverance and being faithful as a model to deal with suffering, I'm also not quite sure that we really know how to do or what to do with it all. Most of the time we simply say, well, suffering is what it is. Be like Job. Be as good as you can be and go from there. If we can, for the present at least, when we sit with Job, I want to lay aside the fundamental question of why any of this happens in the world of life and faith. Because I think we do well to pick up Job as a model more of how do we suffer? How do we get to the storm? How do we keep moving? How do we do any of this with any sort of consistency or integrity? I think there's a lot more in sitting with the how of the thing than the why of the thing, because that gives us what we need for our lives and our reality. A lot more than the bigger metaphysical problems, as important as they may be, it is here. Because when you read the whole text from the vantage point of trying to find million answers on the level of, okay, how, things are not necessarily more clear than they were with the notion of why. But there's at least some models and some threads and some ideas that we can pull on along the way. This vaunted patience of Job, the very thing that has made him a cliche, comes into question when you look at the whole text. Because there's times at which he is downright impatient. He goes through all the stages of grief. Denial, bargaining, anger, depression, acceptance, all along the way with all of his being. And he argues with his questionable friends and with God and openly laments the day of his birth and the faith that carried him. That doesn't sound massively patient, but it does sound massively honest. At times, he displays a level of patience and forbearance that is nothing short of remarkable. But I think we also do well to learn more of how he sits in that forbearance. I think there's a good deal to mine here, and we're going to be sitting with this over the next several weeks when I speak. In reading through the text, and this text in particular, something struck me and got me thinking. And it's actually something that seems like a bit of a throwaway. Because it's just, oh, by the way, his wife came along and said this, and that was the end of that. But imagine what it would be like to be Job's wife. Imagine what it would be like to occupy that space. And it's not particularly easy. it has to be a work of imagination, because all we have are those couple sentences there. This sort of short, testy interaction of, well, here we go, and that's that. And from that brief, momentary thing, she has borne most of the brunt of the historic interpretation of the text. The basic message being, be like Job, be patient, be kind, but don't be like Job's wife, whatever you do. And we dismiss her and her ideas and get on with the rest from there. But consider an unstated but utterly obvious point. Everything that happened to Job is also happening to her. Everything that he has lost, she has lost as well. We can imagine her sitting in the background when, in chapter 1, the messengers come and speak of the calamities that visited the stock and the house and the children, with the refrain of, only I alone was left alive to tell the tale. Her grief was answering that of her husband's, if not exceeding it. His children were her children. His home was her home. The servants, the livestock, the perfection that had been was her perfection too. And it must be said, a mother's grief is qualitatively different than that of a father, though that's a comparison that doesn't bear a whole lot of weight. She gets condemned for not attending to her husband's grief in a time when she was experiencing the same ordeal. And she could not be blamed for wondering if it might not be her who was being tested and subjected to the winds of fate. And now her husband is exhibiting signs of illness. Perhaps her comment to Job was less about Job's attitude at all and more of a simple way of saying, well, I now see that you're the next one that I'm going to lose. Maybe it should just get on with it. Whatever the case may be, at this point in the story, Job had not the ability to encounter her pain as well as his. And Job's words speak the truth of their suffering and remind them both that such things need to be recognized and spoken more than just bared in silence. They are co-sufferers in all of this, despite the fact that, so far as we can discern from the sets, they didn't talk about it, spare this one occasion. Job expresses pain, but not here or now with his wife. His discussion of how he actually feels comes later with his friends. Friends who, observing from the outside, diagnose the situation and a problem of, well, what did you do to God? Because that's always the explanation that comes when we try to figure out the unfathomable. Job's wife knows better. Her question does not find fault in his actions, only questioning his reaction. You persist with your integrity. Why? In doing that, Job's wife reveals the fundamental question that's really at play here. It really is important. How do any of us do any of the hard things of faith with integrity, with promise. This is a far more complicated and important question than simply, what ought we do in the face of suffering generally? Approaching something with integrity, a quality that the Hebrew makes abundantly clear is the central point of the story in the first two chapters of the story. And I could go into all sorts of numerology and explanation of how the Hebrew kept coming back. He was perfect. And Satan and God even cite his integrity along the way. But suffice it to say, it's there, and it's part of the story, and it's that integrity that's being tested far more than necessarily. So let's just see what happens. Job is said to persist with integrity, something which I think he continues in by and large through all that follows. Even when the going gets tough and the temptation is to be ever present and simply say enough and move on to happier pursuits, or even simply give it all up entirely. Because as much as we hold out Job as a symbol of perfection, I think we better hold him up as a symbol of integrity. Perfection is just that. Perfection, it's the one who gets everything right. It's the one who does everything right. But integrity is not about being perfect. It's about being consistent. It's about being persistent and adhering to the basic values and characteristics of who you are. It allows for grief and pain and sorrow in abundance, as well as joy and happiness and all the rest. And calls us only to remain consistent to who do you say that I am? How do you live a life of faith? How do we move forward? Reading Job and Job's wife through the lens of integrity helps us learn from their world and their experience much more than simply aspiring to the impossibility of simply saying, all is well and nothing can harm me. Because we know that when suffering comes, grief will come too. And that does not break our faith, even though it does challenge it. What breaks our faith is when we simply say, well, since it's here, all bets are off. I have a friend in Winnipeg who taught elementary school in French as part of a French immersion program. And she happened on an expression in French that has stuck with me. I forget the French, so I'm not even going to try. But it was a parsing of saying, I am sorry, that goes far beyond just the, oh, I'm sorry, that's my fault, I take responsibility, or, oh, gee, I'm terribly other than that, but rather carries the meaning of, I feel what you are feeling, and I have empathy for what's there. Many times in our lives, it's that sort of compassion, of simply recognizing that what is going on is bad and requires empathy, is needed far more than simply ascribing blame of, well, who did what to whom and when. We need in our lives the sympathy and empathy and compassion. Compassion, whose very etymology means to suffer with, far more than simply knowing who to blame. We hesitate to speak our pain and our suffering because we assume that it needs someone or something ultimately to be pronounced responsible. But sometimes knowing that we are not alone and what we're going through, blasé or extraordinary, can be a healing balm. In our house, we sometimes refer to this in sort of saying, I'm sorry, parentheses, empathy. I'm sorry. To which I mean, I hold sorrow with you. To clarify our meaning, that's simply what we're after. Not anything more. And that helps us remain true to who we want to be and how we want to be in the world. It helps us maintain integrity. Speaking our sorrow while also knowing that we are not alone in it. It's not easy to persist with integrity when the world around you stops making sense. We all know those for whom one crisis of faith or another has led them to throw in the towel on the whole project of faith entirely. Holding on to your values and your principles when things are rough, or worse yet, though principles can feel completely at odds with the moment, can seem pointless or even foolish. Trusting God when God seems to allow things of the world to proceed without impediment can appear naive or even attract ridicule from those around you. And can cause us to question as well. But I'm not sure that that's what's being required of us. I think what's being required of us is not so much as figure out where or why or how things are coming from, but simply to say, yeah, this is what I feel. This is where I am. And to allow that to be enough. Asking a question of God, with whom we may struggle at times, retains the notion that there is someone to ask a question to in the first place. And there's integrity in that. There is hope in that. And there is integrity in expressing the completeness of our emotions and not pretending that everything is okay all the time. Especially when it is not. We can be true to ourselves even when we speak of our challenges in our lives. We can be true to our faith even when we say, but boy howdy, I don't understand this one. Speaking the truth requires integrity. Promises fulfilled, and it opens the conversation in a real way that can lead us to restoration. Pain turned in on itself can be corrosive, doing far more harm as we seek to continue carrying that which we were never meant to carry alone. Bearing up under a challenge does not mean that we somehow become immune to what we need to feel, what we need to grieve, or the challenge of what has been. Job's wife, with her few lines, accomplishes much. She opens a conversation that moves from mere compliance into, in time, a resistance and resilience against that which is happening. And that of itself is a product of hope. We do well to give ourselves space to speak of the challenges that we have, to fully know them for ourselves, for our family, for our brothers and sisters. It allows others to come alongside in compassion, carrying some of what we would struggle with alone, and journey towards healing together. How we do that, where we do that, why we do that, that's more for later. But that we must do that is the imperative of faithfully suffering together. May we read these words and be inspired to greater answers, sympathy, compassion, resistance, and integrity, no matter what we might be facing, knowing that God meets us even in the midst of our challenges and embraces us, come what may. Amen.